say to this man, Go, and he goeth, and to another, Come, and he cometh, and to my servant, Do this, and he doeth it. 363. If then we too strive manfully against disturbances and sins, and can bring them under our own control and discretion, and fight and destroy the passions in our flesh, and bring under the sway of reason the swarm of our thoughts, and drive back from our breasts the terrible hosts of the powers opposed to us by the life-giving standard of the Lord's cross, we shall in reward for such triumphs be promoted to the rank of that centurion, spiritually understood, who, as we read in Exodus, was mystically pointed to by Moses. Appoint for these rulers of thousands and of hundreds and of fifties and of tens, 364. And so we too, when raised to the height of this dignity, shall have the same right and power to command, so that we shall not be carried away by thoughts against our will, but shall be able to continue in and cling to those which spiritually delight us, commanding the evil suggestions to depart, and they will depart, while to good ones we shall say, Come, and they will come. And to our servant also, i.e., the body, we shall in like manner enjoin what belongs to chastity and continence, and it will serve us without any gainsaying, no longer arousing in us the hostile incitements of concupiscence, but showing all subservience to the Spirit. And what is the character of the arms of this centurion, and for what use in battle they are, hear the blessed apostle declaring. The arms, he says, of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty to God. He tells us their character, viz., that they are not carnal or weak, but spiritual and mighty to God. Then he suggests in what struggles they are to be used, unto the pulling down of fortifications, purging the thoughts, and every height that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every understanding unto the obedience of Christ, and having in readiness to avenge all disobedience, when your obedience shall be first fulfilled. 365. And since, though useful, it yet belongs to another time, to run through these one by one, I only want you to see the different sorts of these arms and their characteristics, as we also ought always to walk with them, girt upon us if we mean to fight the Lord's battles and to serve among the centurions of the gospel. Take, he says, the shield of faith, wherewith ye may be able to quench all the fiery darts of the evil one. 366. Faith, then, is that which intercepts the flaming darts of lust and destroys them by the fear of future judgment and belief in the heavenly kingdom. And the breastplate, he says, of charity. 367. This, indeed, is that which, going round the vital parts of the breast and protecting what is exposed to the deadly wounds of swelling thoughts, keeps off the blows opposed to it, and does not allow the darts of the devil to penetrate to our inner man. For it endureth all things, suffereth all things, beareth all things. 368. And for an helmet, the hope of salvation. 369. The helmet is what protects the head. As then Christ is our head, we ought always in all temptations and persecutions to protect it with the hope of future good things to come, and especially to keep faith in him whole and undefiled. For it is possible for one who has lost other parts of the body, weak as he may be, still to survive, but even a short time of living is extended to no one without a head. And the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. 370. For it is sharper than any two-edged sword, and piercing even to the dividing of soul and spirit, and of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. 371. As it divides and cuts off whatever carnal and earthly thing it may find in us, and whosoever is protected by these arms will ever be defended from the weapons and ravages of his foes, and will not be led away bound in the chains of his spoilers, a captive and a prisoner, to the hostile land of vain thoughts, nor hear the words of the prophet, Why art thou grown old in a strange country? 372. But he will stand like a triumphant conqueror in the land of thoughts which he has chosen. Would you understand, too, the strength and courage of this centurion, by which he bears these arms of which we spoke before, as not carnal but mighty to God? Hear of the selection by which the king himself marks and approves brave men when he summons them to the spiritual combat. Let, says he, the weak say that I am strong, and let him who is the sufferer become a warrior. 373. You see, then, that none but sufferers and weak people can fight the Lord's battles, weak indeed with that weakness, founded on which that centurion of ours in the gospel said with confidence, "For when I am weak, then am I strong." And again, "For strength is made perfect in weakness." 374. Of which weakness one of the prophets says, "And he that is weak among them shall be as the house of David." 375. For the patient sufferer shall fight these wars with that patience of which it is said, "Patience is necessary for you, that doing the will of God you may receive the reward." 376. Chapter 6. Of Perseverance as Regards Care of the Thoughts. But we shall find out by our own experience that we can and ought to cling to the Lord if we have our wills mortified and the desires of this world cut off. And we shall be taught by the authority of those who, in converse with the Lord, say in all confidence, "My soul hath stuck close to thee, and I have stuck unto thy testimonies, O Lord. And it is good for me to stick fast to God, and he who cleaveth to the Lord is one spirit." 377. We ought not then to be wearied out by these wanderings of mind and relax from our fervor, for he that tilleth his ground shall be filled with bread, but he that followeth idleness shall be filled with poverty. 378. Nor should we be drawn away from being intent on this watchfulness through a dangerous despair. For in every one who is anxious there is abundance. For he who is pleasant and free from grief will be in want. And again, a man in grief labors for himself and forcibly brings about his own destruction. 379. Moreover also, the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence, and the violent take it by force. 380. For no virtue is acquired without effort, nor can anyone attain to that mental stability which he desires without great sorrow of heart. For man is born to trouble. 381. And in order that he may be able to attain to the perfect man the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. 382. He must ever be on the watch with still greater intentness, and toil with ceaseless carefulness. But to the fullness of this measure no one will ever attain. But one who has considered it beforehand and been trained to it now, and has had some foretaste of it while still in this world, and being marked a most precious member of Christ, has possessed in the flesh an earnest of that joint, 383, by which he can be united to his body, desiring one thing alone, thirsting but for one thing, ever bringing not only his acts but even his thoughts to bear on one thing alone, viz., that he may even now keep as an earnest that which is said of the blessed life of the saints hereafter, viz., that God may be to him all in all. 384. Chapter 7. A question on the roving tendency of the mind and the attacks of spiritual wickedness. Germanus. Perhaps this tendency of the mind to rove might to some extent be checked, were it not that so great a swarm of enemies surrounded it, and ceaselessly urged it toward what it has no wish for, or rather whither the roving character of its own nature drives it. And since such numberless foes, and those so powerful and terrible, surround it, we should not fancy that it was possible for them to be withstood, especially by this weak flesh of ours, were we not encouraged to this view by your words, as if by oracles from heaven. Chapter 8. The Answer on the Help of God and the Power of Free Will. Serenus. No one who has experienced the conflicts of inner man can doubt that our foes are continually lying in wait for us. But we mean that they oppose our progress in such a way that we can think of them as only inciting to evil things and not forcing. But no one could altogether avoid whatever sin they were inclined to imprint upon our hearts, if a strong impulse were present to force evil upon us, just as it is to suggest it. Wherefore, as there is in them ample power of inciting, so in us there is a supply of power of rejection and of liberty of acquiescing. But if we are afraid of their power and assaults, we may also claim the protection and assistance of God against them, of which we read, "For greater is he who is in us than he who is in this world," 385. "And his aid fights on our side with much greater power than their hosts fight against us. For God is not only the suggester of what is good, but the maintainer and insister of it, so that sometimes he draws us toward salvation even against our will and without our knowing it. It follows then that no one can be deceived by the devil but one who has chosen to yield to him the consent of his own will. As Ecclesiastes clearly put it in these words, "For since there is no gainsaying by those who do evil speedily, therefore the heart of the children of men is filled within them to do evil." 386. It is therefore clear that each man goes wrong from this, viz., that when evil thoughts assault him, he does not immediately meet them with refusal and contradiction. For it says, "Resist him, and he will flee from you." 387. Chapter 9. A question on the union of the soul with devils. Germanus. What I pray you is that indiscriminate and common union of the soul with those evil spirits by which it is possible for them to be, I will not say joined with, but united to it in such a way that they can and find their way into it and suggest to it whatever they want and incite it to whatever they like and look into and see its thoughts and movements. And the result is so close a union between them and the soul that it is almost impossible without God's grace to distinguish between what results from their instigation and what from our free will. Chapter 10. The answer, how unclean spirits are united with human souls. Serenus. It is no wonder that spirit can be imperceptibly joined with spirit and exercise an unseen power of persuasion toward what is allowed to it. For there is between them, just as between men, some sort of similarity and kinship of substance, since the description which is given of the nature of the soul applies equally well to their substance. But it is impossible for spirits to be implanted in spirits inwardly or united with them in such a way that one can hold the other, for this is the true prerogative of deity alone, which is the only simple and incorporeal nature. Chapter 11. An objection whether unclean spirits can be present in or united with the souls of those whom they have filled. Germanus. To this idea we think that what we see happen in the case of those possessed is sufficiently opposed, when they say and do what they know not under the influence of the spirits. How then are we to refuse to believe that their souls are not united to those spirits, when we see them made their instruments, and, forsaking their natural condition, yielding to their movements and moods in such a way that they give expression no longer to their own words and actions and wishes, but to those of the demons? Chapter 12. The answer how it is that unclean spirits can lord it over those possessed. Serenus. What you speak of as taking place in the case of demoniacs is not opposed to our assertion, viz., that those possessed by unclean spirits say and do what they do not want to, and are forced to utter what they know not, for it is perfectly clear that they are not subject to the entrance of the spirits all in the same way. For some are affected by them in such a way as to have not the slightest conception of what they do and say, while others know and afterwards recollect it. But we must not imagine that this is done by the infusion of the spirit in such a way that it penetrates into the actual substance of the soul, and being as it were united to it and somehow clothed with it, utters words and sayings through the mouth of the sufferer. For we ought not to believe that this can possibly be done by them. For we can clearly see that this results from no loss of the soul, but from weakness of the body. When the unclean spirit seizes on those members in which the vigor of the soul resides, and laying on them an enormous and intolerable weight, overwhelms it with foulest darkness, and interferes with its intellectual powers, as we see sometimes happen also from the fault of wine and fever or excessive cold, and other indispositions affecting men from without, And it was this which the devil was forbidden to attempt to inflict on the blessed Job, though he had received power over his flesh, when the Lord commanded him, saying, Lo, I give him into thine hands, only preserve his soul. 388, i.e., do not weaken the seed of his soul and make him mad, and overpower the understanding and wisdom of what remains by smothering the ruling power in his heart with your weight. Chapter 13. How spirit cannot be penetrated by spirit, and how God alone is incorporeal. For even if spirit is mingled with this crass and solid matter, viz., flesh, as very easily happens, should we therefore believe that it can be united to the soul, which is in like manner spirit, in such a way as to make it also receptive in the same way of its own nature, a thing which is possible to the Trinity alone, which is so capable of pervading every intellectual nature, that it cannot only embrace and surround it, but even insert itself into it, and incorporeal though it is, be infused into a body? For though we maintain that some spiritual nature exists, such as angels, archangels, and other powers, and indeed our own souls and the thin air, yet we ought certainly not to consider them incorporeal. For they have in their own fashion a body in which they exist, though it is much finer than our bodies are, in accordance with the Apostle's words when he says, And there are bodies celestial and bodies terrestrial. And again, it is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. 389. From which it is clearly gathered that there is nothing incorporeal about God alone, and therefore it is only by him that all spiritual and intellectual substances can be pervaded, because he alone is whole and everywhere and in all things, in such a way as to behold and see the thoughts of men and their inner movements and all the recesses of the soul, since it was of him alone that the blessed apostle spoke when he said, For the word of God is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, and piercing even to the dividing of soul and spirit and of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. And there is no creature invisible in his sight, but all things are naked and open to his eyes. 390. And the blessed David says, Who fashioneth their hearts one by one? And again, For he knoweth the secrets of hearts. 391. And Job 2, Thou who alone knowest the hearts of men. 392. Chapter 14. An objection as to how we ought to believe that devils see into the thoughts of men. Germanus. In this way which you describe, those spirits cannot possibly see into our thoughts. But we think it utterly absurd to hold such an opinion, when Scripture says, If the spirit of him that hath power ascend upon thee. 393. And again, when the devil had put it into the heart of Simon Iscariot to betray the Lord. 394. How then can we believe that our thoughts are not open to them, when we feel that, for the most part, they spring up and are nursed by their suggestions and instigation? Chapter 15. The answer what devils can and what they cannot do in regard to the thoughts of men. Serenus. Nobody doubts that unclean spirits can influence the character of our thoughts, but this is by affecting them from without by sensible influences, i.e., either from our inclinations or from our words, and those likings to which they see that we are especially disposed. But they cannot possibly come near to those which have not yet come forth from the inmost recesses of the soul. And the thoughts, too, which they suggest, whether they are actually or in a kind of way embraced, are discovered by them not from the nature of the soul itself, i.e., that inner inclination which lies concealed, so to speak, in the very marrow, but from motions and signs given by the outward man. As, for example, when they suggest gluttony, if they have seen a monk raising his eyes